From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Did some big-time journalists hold their tongues about the buildup to war? A new book by former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan has got some top journalists talking. Meanwhile, soldier suicides are the highest in nearly two decades. And the first black governor of New York makes his mark. For more, we have Corey Dade, Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Also, radio show host Cynthia Pryor Hardy of On Point with Cynthia Hardy. And Ernie Suggs, urban affairs reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi, folks.
Hey, how you doing?
So there's so much to talk about this week. You know, this Scott McClellan memoir, Tell All, is just all over the place. Let me start with you, Corey. What do you make of how he assesses whether the White House was willing to tell the truth, willing to participate in a dialogue, I guess, with the journalist and with the American public?
I think this is just the latest confirmation of what journalists have talked about for the last few years, which is the lack of disclosure, the infringement upon the public's right to know in general, and especially the infringement on freedom of the press. But I think about the coverage issues as it relates to the war in Iraq. And I was in Boston at the Boston Globe when America went to war, and we did a lot of coverage of 9/11 in particular because because the planes originated from Boston, and many Bostonians or Massachusetts residents died in those fires at the Twin Towers. And so for us, we had a difficult job. We had to absorb the feelings of and the opinions of the public and articulate them to, you know, in print. But at the same time, we had to stay removed. So I think all journalists had a difficult job there. But I think this really deals with the elite journalists who cover the White House and the Pentagon and the pressures that they did face, because it's clear that they did face pressures to make sure that they didn't go too far in criticizing this administration.
Cynthia, do you think the pressure just came from the White House or from the federal government, or did it come from people who just said, I don't want to hear America criticized at a time like this? I mean, what were you hearing as you went about your work as a talk show host?
Well, I think that journalists, you know, by and large, want to be fair and want to be objective, but I think we have to remember that during the post 9/11 time that people in general felt vulnerable, they felt exposed, there was a lot of patriotic feelings in the air. Having said that, though, our news media is supposed to be an objective sounding board of sort, a filter that we can kind of count on to let the general public know the real deal. And most commercial media outlets, however, generally reflect some kind of a slant. Not that the media is intentionally dishonest, but let's face it, we're selective about what we cover and what we deem news to be. So I just think that it isn't necessarily the media's role to wage a campaign for or against an action, but rather to provide some kind of objective information for readers, for viewers, for listeners to be able to discern for themselves. And to a large extent, I just don't know that the public had the appetite to hear anything other than something that was going to make us feel whole again after feeling that we had been violated at 9/11.
Ernie, if there had been more aggressive coverage right on time with the build-up to war, do you think people would have been mad at it?
I don't think people would have been mad at it, but I think that as Corey said, you're dealing with the elite media here, and you're dealing, if you're looking at it on a micro level or a mini level, a micro level or a maxi level, any kind of administration is going to try to dictate what the coverage is. It's going to be a matter of those publications and those news outlets to try to manage that dictation that the White House or the mayor's house or the governor's house is trying to dictate on the media. I don't think that necessarily the elite media, as Corey said, did as aggressive a job as they could have perhaps done. But I do think, on the other hand, that some of the questions were asked. We were just dealing with the White House that, as McClellan has stated, and as we've known for the last 8 years, that is very, very knows how to work with the media, knows how to, I guess, get their point across through the media, and that, in a way, has impacted how we cover it. It has impacted how the news has filtered out to our readers and our listeners.
Corey, before we move on, There are a few people who are talking about this right now. CNN congressional correspondent Jessica Yellen was working at MSNBC right before the war, and she says she felt producers ran broadcasts that were consistent with what she calls, quote, patriotic fever in the country during the time. And then Katie Couric of CBS News said there was a pressure. Do you feel that pressure at all now in any way to shape your coverage?
On the print side, I think we have the luxury, as it were, to not be so tightly adhered to ratings for every segment of our reporting. And I think on the TV side, you know, when you look at public sentiment, it is very much correlated to ratings in the minds of TV executives, and so that kind of drives what they'd like to put on air. In the case of print, you know. No, I don't feel, I personally don't feel, and most of my colleagues don't feel, any overt or even low-key or subliminal pressure to play up any sentiments from the public in our coverage that reflect patriotism. I think at this point there is sort of a reflexive overcorrection among the media to actually be far more scrutinizing of this administration.
Cynthia, let me go to something that's related, which is just how the war is playing out. And there's a case where Army suicides are up. A new report says that there's a 13% increase over the past year in soldier suicides. 40% of the suicides happen stateside after the soldiers have come home. Cynthia, what do you think folks in journalism should be covering about this story?
I think we all should recognize the fact that there's a lot going on in the heads of these guys that that we're not talking about. And I think part of it, when you look at the number of folks that commit suicide once they get stateside, I think that we have to recognize the fact that they, too, you know, are conflicted about what it is that they have done and the reasons for which they've done it. I think it must be terribly troubling mentally. Particularly when we look at the talk that we're having now about it not being a war of necessity but being a war of choice, and to think of what they've been through and what they've seen and what they've given, it must leave them questioning. And I think that we have to factor all of that in. I think along with our conversations about the fact that we're seeing the suicides, is as much as we can do on this side to try to help with post-traumatic stress and recognize that we're not doing all that we can for our veterans when they come back, and any lobbying, you know, that can be done should be done.
Ernie, you're an urban affairs reporter, and there is a large population of both soldiers and veterans who come from America's urban communities and America's black communities. What are you hearing about how people are thinking about the war and or how veterans are being treated?
In terms of veterans, you know, you can look at it every day here in Atlanta, seeing homeless men. You know, Atlanta has a huge homeless population. I don't know how many of those are from the most recent Gulf War, but I think that shows a trend that could be a national trend of how returning veterans from World War II or from Vietnam or Korea, wherever, are coming home and are not getting the services that they should be entitled to as defenders of our country. So you have a lot of talk about, you know, what is the government doing? You know, you had a report a couple of days ago about a woman who said that she had to rely on charities to get help. You know, that shouldn't be the case. And I think that a lot of people in urban areas are seeing the effect of seeing these soldiers come home without benefits, without jobs, without education, and are suffering for it. You know, when I was in college, you know, in 1985 to 1990, a lot of my classmates went, you know, were in the Army just to get, or not just to get, but to, you know, as a benefit to get an education. And they were gone on the weekends, and, you know, they weren't at step practice or whatever, and they were, you know, we knew what their obligations were. And now, you know, with this war going on, it's a whole different dynamic that I don't even know if I don't think that we are looking at service the way we used to. And subsequently, when these people are coming home, they're not being treated as they should be treated.
All right. We're entering a speed round. This is going to have to be short. New York Governor David Paterson has taken a stand on gay marriages, and they can't be performed in New York per se. But he's saying state agencies should recognize gay marriages that are performed where they are legal in places like Massachusetts and California. You know, Paterson came in and kind of swept up after the sex scandal in New York State. And now some people are saying this is a bold but risky move, given that he's got a whole bunch of things on his plate. Corey, do you think that this will help shape policy, or will it help undermine his governorship?
I don't think he risks much political capital here. New York state politics, certainly in the city, but even in the state, are somewhat left of center on the issue of same-sex marriage, despite having years of Republican rule both in City Hall and in Albany. And so I think the legal provisions here give a blueprint for gay rights activists to, in other states and in New York, to fight harder for civil unions, for marriages in general, and beyond that, for the governor. The gay rights community in New York is very powerful, and they're large in number. And so for him, this allows him to establish a broader base politically, because he comes in being sort of a political insider, longtime state legislator. And so this gives him another constituency that he can use for his reelection. So I think for him, he doesn't risk much at this point at all.
Cynthia, if you had to give his gubernatorial run so far a grade, you know, he's worked on everything from pardoning Slick Rick to the gay marriage issue to working on whether or not nooses should be illegal. How do you think he's doing so far?
I think he's kind of bold. I'd give him a B. I really would, especially, you know, given the fact that he did the Slick Rick thing. I mean, a number of, when you look at the Second Chance Act that Congressman Clyburn helped to sponsor in Congress, and you know what it's supposed to do. I like the fact that he's bold enough to do what he thinks needs to be done. He's been very open about his own life, you know, so that to get some of that political baggage at least put to the side, so that he can deal with issues. I kind of like the boldness about what he's doing, so I'd give him a B.
All right, you're a tough grader, girl. All right, guys, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Cynthia Pryor Hardy. She's the host of the radio program On Point with Cynthia Hardy, which airs in Columbia, South Carolina. Ernie Suggs is the urban affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Corey Dade is the Atlanta correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and he joined us from member station WABE in Atlanta. This is NPR News. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today, for the final installment of our criminal justice series, we take a look at the death penalty. The United States comes fifth in placing in the world when it comes to executing inmates. We fall slightly above Iraq and right below Pakistan. But the death penalty has always been controversial in America. Since the death penalty was reinstated in the mid-1970s, all death row inmates have been put to death for killing another person. But now a surprising array of crimes can land you on death row. For a broader look at capital punishment, we have Richard Dieter, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
So, 3,000 people, more than that, are on death row. 42 people were executed in 2007. Half of them were African Americans. What has been the breakdown racially and in terms of other demographics of people who actually, you know, go on death row or are executed?
Well, the numbers of African Americans on death row is about 42% compared to their numbers in the population of about 12%. So there's a disproportionate number of African Americans on death row. The numbers executed is a little less, about 34%, but still disproportionate. However, the biggest factor in race and the death penalty is that it depends whom you kill. In the murder that got you on death row, if you kill a white person, then you really have a death penalty case. It's four or five times more likely that a person, white or black, will get the death penalty if they killed a white person than if they killed the black person, which is sort of putting a value on the victim's lives by color.
So basically, all crimes are not equal. That's what you're saying.
That's right. That's the way it breaks down. If a crime is committed in a poor part of town or someone who isn't, you know, influential in the DA's race or office or you know, not a contributor, that may be prosecuted. It may get a punishment, but it's not necessarily a death penalty case. Almost always it isn't. in the reverse is a death penalty case.
Richard, when you take a look at these issues, how do they play out by states? Don't states have very different approaches to the death penalty?
Yeah, U.S. ranks the fifth in the world in terms of the death penalty, but the death penalty in the U.S. is not at all uniform. Over 80% of the executions in the U.S. are in the South, and that has been true since 1976 when the death penalty came back, and it's true every year. It was even a higher percentage last year with 26 out of the 42 executions just in one state, Texas. Over 60% just in one state. So the states that have had a history of racial divisiveness, not that that's not a problem everywhere, but where slavery and segregation were law, those are the states leading with executions, whether there's how deep the connections go, but, there continue to be problems with jury selection, with statements made by prosecutors and even defense attorneys that would be considered, totally out of line in most areas, but have happened in courtrooms across the U.S.
Let's talk about a specific case. There was a 1977 ruling called Coker versus Georgia, and it said that executing someone for the rape of an adult, if the crime didn't also include murder, was unconstitutional. So what did that mean, and why was it important?
Well, that was a case of a rape of an adult woman, and the Supreme Court said that the death penalty would be disproportionate because the victim did not die, but they obviously left open the possibility that what if the victim were a child? And so that's where this issue has now become important. A few states, like Louisiana, have passed laws that would allow the death penalty, even if there's not a murder, if a child was sexually assaulted. And the U.S. Supreme Court took a case from Louisiana. They're the only state with someone on death row for this. And we're awaiting their decision. It could signal opening the death penalty to the crime of rape again, or it could indicate that if we're going to have the death penalty, there has to be a death or a murder involved. That's where the American consensus is on this issue, and that ruling will come by the end of June.
When you say the American consensus, you mean Americans in general favor the death penalty when someone's been killed but don't when someone has not been killed?
Well, that question's rarely asked in polls, but yes, essentially that's right. And the way you'd measure that is the fact that 45 state legislatures don't allow the death penalty except if there's a murder. And there have been no one executed for any crime but murder since 1976. There's only two people on death row anywhere in the whole country out of the 3,300 who are there for any crime but murder, and those are both in Louisiana, and one is the case before the Supreme Court. So through its legislatures, through its juries, through its review of this issue, there appears to be a consensus that the death penalty is approved for murder, but we don't do it for other offenses, That is the question before the court, but I think a fair reading of most of the country is that they don't have it. It's not to say that if you ask the person and describe their particularly horrible sexual assault, they would say kill the guy, but that's different from having a law. The history of rape and the death penalty and race is even worse than the death penalty generally. It was almost exclusively used against blacks for raping whites.
When you look at America now, where there has been this whole exoneration movement of, investigators looking into who has been falsely sent to death row, as well as all of the other factors around investigations of incarceration and who gets sent to jail, where do you see the death penalty going in the future in terms of how states examine it and how individual citizens examine it?
Actually, the death penalty is on the decline, and I think the innocence cases, the description you just gave of mistakes, DNA, that has led to a skepticism about the death penalty, not a complete rejection, but death sentences are down about 60% since 1999 in this country. and executions have also dropped. The size of death row has dropped. And generally, the public is now more willing to impose life without parole as an alternative to the death penalty, and they support that in public opinion polls. So I think there is a chance that the death penalty may wind down, and as I mentioned, it's already mostly being practiced in the South, at least in terms of executions, and even there, there was a case recently in Texas where a illegal immigrant received a life sentence for the murder of a police officer in Houston, Texas. This is just last week. That's unheard of, but may indicate that things are changing even in Texas.
Richard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Richard Dieter is the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. And now we're going to turn to the case of a Louisiana man who was sentenced to death, but not for murder. Patrick Kennedy is on death row at Louisiana's Angola prison, awaiting capital punishment for brutally raping his 8-year-old stepdaughter. The last person executed for rape was in 1964, and Kennedy's case could change how the death penalty is applied. But does executing someone for child rape violate the Eighth Amendment that bars cruel and unusual punishment? For more, we have Ted Cruz, the former Solicitor General of Texas, who also participated in Patrick Kennedy's Supreme Court appeal, and Judy Benitez, the Executive Director of the Louisiana Foundation Against Sexual Assault. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Good to be with you, Farai.
So we were just speaking with Richard Dieter from the Death Penalty Information Center, and we talked about what crimes warrant capital punishment. So I'm going to ask each of you, Ted first, what do you think is fair game for the death penalty, the ultimate punishment, the irreversible punishment?
Well, that's precisely the question that's before the Supreme Court in the Kennedy case. And in particular, the question is whether the Constitution permits elected state legislatures to determine that the most egregious child rapist should be eligible for the most serious punishment. 7 elected legislatures in different states have determined that the answer to that is yes, and the question before the court is whether the Constitution permits those legislatures to make that determination.
How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, this is a case that I think the court is wrestling with. It is a case that the court has never considered before. Some 3 decades ago, the court concluded that capital punishment was unconstitutional with respect to the rape of an adult woman. But that opinion repeatedly and explicitly limited its reach to the rape of an adult woman, and it left open the question before the court today in Kennedy, which is whether the rape of a young child, in the Kennedy case, it was an 8-year-old girl who was brutally and violently raped, whether that is different and whether that crime is so serious, is so grave, that it is permissible for state legislatures to determine that juries should have the option to provide the most serious punishment for the most egregious offenders.
Judy, it sounds, at least on the surface, like it might be a good idea to hold someone to the strictest accountability for a crime like this, but you seem to have some reservations about the death penalty as a punishment. What would those be?
Well, our main concern is not the impact of the death penalty on the offender, but the impact on the victim, the potential impact. Because of the fact that most child rapists are someone that the child knows and cares about, it's a family member, a caretaker of some sort, someone that has access to that child and has a relationship with the child, as was the case in the Kennedy case. And our concern comes from the fact that we know that child sexual abuse is already very underreported. We know that from adults who come forward and say, you know, this happened to me and I never told anyone. There's a lot of research around this. And our concern is that if the possibility of the death penalty is out there, which the offenders will make sure that their child victims know, that will increase underreporting, because you have to have not just the child be willing to come forward and possibly expose this person that they have ambivalent feelings toward. They want the abuse to stop, but they care about the person. They have to be willing to expose them to the possibility of the death penalty, and whatever adult to whom they disclose also has to be willing to take that chance.
Do you think that these crimes like child assault, are crimes of opportunity or crimes that require a lot of premeditation? Not that those are exclusive, but what you're talking about is really people changing their patterns of criminal behavior because they know the law.
Well, I think that absolutely they are things that are crimes that are premeditated. There's a grooming process that goes on most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time with child sexual abuse, there is a grooming process in which the offender is sort of testing the waters to see if this child is, how they're going to react if he attempts to perpetrate an assault. He may, start out with something that's not quite as severe and then move on to a rape or a molestation of some sort. So, yeah, there is a process that goes on, absolutely.
Ted, when you think about how the death penalty should be applied, there's obviously a lot of different people involved in how law evolves. There's juries, there's judges, there's prosecutors. But where do you think we should be heading? This is obviously extremely, it's just incontrovertible. Once you kill someone, they're dead. So what's the standard we should follow?
Well, I think questions like that are ultimately policy questions. I mean, the concerns that Judy is raising, I think are all fair and serious concerns that should be considered. But the question before the Supreme Court is, what is the proper forum to evaluate those policy concerns? Is it a federal court? Is it unelected, lifetime-appointed federal judges? Or is it the elected legislatures of the 50 states and the United States Congress? And the position of the state of Texas, I argued on behalf of Texas and a total of 9 states that were supporting the state of Louisiana, and the position of the amici states was that it is elected legislatures that are best situated to hear all the evidence, to listen to the arguments of the advocates, to listen to the concerns Judy's raising, and also to consider the arguments on the other side. A number of legislatures have looked to the data, for example. Recent economic studies indicate, for example, the deterrent effect of capital punishment, that each individual who is executed for murder, the economic data suggests, prevents up to 18 future murders. That deterrent effect is potentially quite significant. And it was the position of the amici states that federal courts are not well situated to evaluate those competing policy claims. Rather, it's elected legislatures that are ultimately accountable to the people.
When you say amici states, those are states that signed on to essentially the argument of the court.
That's exactly right. The particular case concerned this one individual in Louisiana, Patrick Kennedy, who is a 300-pound man who violently raped an 8-year-old girl. And did so savagely that it required reconstructive surgery to repair the damage he did to this little girl. 9 other states supported the state of Louisiana because those states believed that the question of what the permissible punishment should be for the most egregious child rapists is a question that should be decided by elected legislatures. And I would note that if the question is left to legislatures, the answer, I expect, would be different in different states. Some state legislatures would assess it and conclude it is an appropriate punishment, and others would conclude it's not an appropriate punishment.
Judy, just quickly, what do you think, who do you think should weigh in on this? Obviously, you're speaking in part because of the victim's perspective. Who should speak up in terms of having their voices heard as these decisions are being made?
Well, I agree that it is probably a better process in terms of public policy for advocates for victims and for survivors who do feel comfortable coming forward to speak out when the issue is being considered by state legislatures. And I should point out that there are 5 state legislatures this term only who have looked at this and rejected the idea, including 3 southern states, Missouri, Colorado, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee have all rejected the idea. That did not happen in this case, and so I would say that the concerns of victims need to be considered at whatever point we are looking at in the criminal justice process, particularly in sexual assault cases and particularly in child cases, because children and sexual assault victims do not like to come forward and talk about what has happened to them. It's very traumatic.
All right. Well, Judy, Ted, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You.
Good to be with you.
Ted Cruz is the former Solicitor General of Texas, and Judy Benitez is the Executive Director of the Louisiana Foundation Against Sexual Assault, and she spoke to us from WRFK in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Ratings for her daytime show are down, her magazine circulation numbers are falling, and a poll shows her popularity just isn't what it used to be. Is Oprah paying a price for publicly supporting Barack Obama's presidential campaign? Plus, Jennifer Hudson won an Oscar for Dreamgirls, so why did she take a small part in a big film? Plus, Lawrence Fishburne gets a Tony Award nomination for his portrayal of Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. To help us talk about these issues, we've got our entertainment guru, Allison Samuels of Newsweek magazine. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
You look fabulous because we're on camera.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a webcast,
okay,
so
well,
we're working things out. So good thing we both look fresh and smiling.
Always.
Anyway, let's talk about Oprah. Her TV show, her magazine, popularity in general, taking a hit.
Right.
Do you think it's because she picked a candidate in this race?
I think that's probably partially what it is. I mean, she does have a very mainstream audience of women who, a lot of them supported Hillary Clinton. So I'm sure that had something to do with it. But I also think it's just a sign of the times. I mean, she's been dominant for a very long time. And, you know, there comes a time when that ends, or it certainly begins to fall off a little bit. And I sort of think it's a combination of both. I don't think it's just her support of Obama, because if you think about it, she really has not really been out there supporting him since January. She did her thing and she pretty much stepped away from it. But I think that when you combine that with the fact that she's dominated for 20 years and Ellen now is sort of the popular person with all the celebrity guests, I just think it's time to pass the mantle on some level.
Oprah can pass the mantle anytime and still be a billionaire.
Definitely.
And an entrepreneur, multimedia business owner. Nonetheless, if you're that good at something, it's got to sting a little bit, doesn't it?
See, I don't think it does. I think that Oprah is at a point in her career and in her life where she's done what she wants to do. I think that that's why she felt comfortable coming out for Obama, because I think she understood that that might affect her ratings. I think she felt like, you know what, this is I've succeeded far beyond anybody's expectations. So now I can take a stand and take the hit if there is one to come. So I think she's fine with it. I think she is looking forward to her next, you know, sort of, you know, plateau and like where she goes from here.
So there have been cases where people have criticized her for not following Christian doctrine because she promotes spiritual authors like Eckhart Tolle. People will criticize her for any number of reasons, and we all have reasons to pick or choose one media person over another. But where do you think she'll go from here? She has incredible resources.
Right.
And where do you see her in the next 10 years?
I can see her doing, I mean, I know one of the things that she told me when I interviewed her for her school in South Africa is that she really wanted to spend much more time there. She wanted to actually build a house, and I think she is building a house on the property, and she wanted to live there. So I can just sort of see her just slowly getting out of the spotlight, because, I mean, she's had a 20-year run at just being always on the front page and people always around her and media always there. I mean, I think at this point she would just like to take a break for a minute, produce, you know, sort of help other people. But I'm not sure that she wants that in front of the camera thing in the next 10 years. I'm not sure that's where she wants to be.
All right. Speaking in front of the camera, we've got Jennifer Hudson. She won an Academy Award for Dreamgirls, but now she's got a role as Carrie Bradshaw's assistant in Sex and the City. Some folks are saying, oh, that's beneath you, honey. What do you think?
Well, it was beneath her, but I sort of feel like even more so it was a very clumsy addition to it. She didn't really fit in the movie when I saw it. I felt like, you know, someone like Kelly Rowland or someone with a, you know, not as big as a profile as Jennifer would have been better. I also sort of feel as though with Jennifer, though, as with any other African-American actress, it's going to be hard finding roles that equal Dreamgirls. So I think, you know, I didn't expect her to do anything huge after Dreamgirls. I think that's just sort of the name of the game. When you're an African-American actress, you take what you can get. And this is a big film. It's a small role, but it's in a huge movie that will probably do incredibly well. I just thought she was ill-fitted. I didn't think she belonged in it.
Kelly Rowland, you mentioned her name, Destiny's Child.
Right.
She basically said she wanted the part.
Right.
What do you think she would have done with it?
I just think it would have been less awkward in the sense of Jennifer has a presence that's overwhelming, and it didn't really make sense for her to have such a small role. Now, part of it is that I just think the movie itself and Sex and the City had ignored African-Americans for the entire run on TV, and it just felt like, okay, let's just throw one in now because, you know, we don't want to hear any sort of criticism. So But Kelly, I think, would have brought that sort of, you know, it girl kind of quality to it because she's a fashionista. And I don't look at Jennifer Hudson in the same way. I don't get that from her. So that's why I thought it was a really awkward fit. But, you know, Kelly, she didn't have an acting background. And I think they went for the name and for the Oscar. And that's obviously Jennifer.
So let's talk about Tony nominations. Mm-hmm. There are so many musicals with non-white characters or actors that got a huge number of the nominations. Mm-hmm. And tell us about some of those.
The interesting part is the ones that got it, but also the ones that not, like Cattin' on the Hot Tin Roof, that Debbie Allen, you know, actually directs, and Felicia Rashad and Terrence Howard. I think a lot of people were shocked that didn't get any nominations whatsoever. I was sort of shocked, too. I thought, you know, Debbie at least would get a nomination. Or Terrence, who's, you know, phenomenal. But I think Lawrence Fishburne for Thurgood, got one for Best Actor. And I saw it. We have to mention,
you have a family relationship.
Oh, yeah. He's my first cousin.
Not that that means that's why you love him.
No. And
he's one of my favorite actors.
He's amazing. And in this one-man show, it's 90 minutes where he's on stage, just him. And he just carries it. He commands the stage. And I think that's an incredibly hard thing to do. And he does it with ease. So I think him as a Best Actor nomination, I can see that being sort of – I can see him winning it. Because I think – the critics really see that when you're the only person on stage. That is very hard to sort of do. So I can sort of see him being sort of not a shoe-in, but certainly the favorite.
What else are we seeing on Broadway in terms of, you know, people of color and nominations?
Well, Morgan Freeman is in Country Girl now. And I've not seen it, but I really want to see it because it's supposedly very, very good. And just to see him on Broadway, because I've never really thought of him as a Broadway actor, even though I know he's done theater for a long time. But I've never seen that. So I think that's sort of what the buzz is now, to actually go to Broadway and just see him on stage. Because I think you see actors in a totally different way when they're on stage. And it's them. You get the essence of who they are from that stage performance. And to see it be consistent every night, you know, because with Lawrence, he does two or three performances on the weekends. And it's like, I'm just like, wow, I don't think I could do that. Because it's such an intense portrayal and such an intense study of Thurgood Marshall that you're going, you know, for that 90 minutes, you have to just become that person and just blot all of yourself out. And I know as an actor, you do that anyway. But on stage, there's no room for error.
When you think about how acting unfolds in American public life, there are a lot of people, most people who we know as actors, I mean, certainly who I know, are people who act in movies or television, who we can see kind of as a big group of Americans.
Right.
But theater is something different. Theater is smaller, more intimate, fewer people in the audience. What's the significance of still doing theater, even if you're a big Broadway, a big Hollywood star?
I think it's the craft. I think theater is the true craft of acting. And I think your best movie stars, your best movie stars are ones who started on stage. I mean, Denzel went back and did Julius Caesar a couple of years ago. And I think it was just sort of to hone those skills, because that's something where you have to be on your toes. You're challenging yourself. You have to remember the lines. There's no cuts. There's no second chances. You have to get it the first take. And I think for actors like Morgan Freeman or Denzel or Lawrence Fishburne, it's that challenge again, because I think movies and TV, you know, becomes the same old, same old. And with stage, every night is a different night. It's the unknown.
What about the audiences? Do you think enough black people or a broad enough cross-section are going to theater?
Well, at Thurgood the other day, it was a very mixed audience, which I was really happy about. I think part of that is the Tony nominations. I mean, it definitely helps when you get a nomination like that, because then the buzz really becomes loud. And I think, you know, Thurgood Marshall is someone that, you know, African-Americans certainly have a special, you know, relationship with. But I was very happy with the mixture of the crowd.
Allison, as always, great to talk to you.
Thank you.
That was Allison Samuel. She's the entertainment writer for Newsweek magazine, and she joined us from our NPR studios in Culver City, California. Let's stay together, tired of being alone, love and happiness. After all these hits, Al Green is taking his six-decade career in new directions. His latest CD is called Lay It Down. It has him working with a new generation of artists like Questlove, the drummer for the hip-hop band The Roots, and the producer of Lay It Down. NPR's Tony Cox caught up with Al Green to talk about the new CD.
Al Green, welcome to the show. It's wonderful to have you on. How you doing?
I'm just fine. I'm just glad to be on NPR. You know, how you doing?
Listen, I got to tell you a quick story.
Okay.
I was talking about you at the barbershop yesterday. Okay. Apparently, you performed at the opening of the Galen Center out here at USC in LA last year. And so I asked the barber, and you know how it is in the barbershop. I asked the barber, so how'd he sound? And he said, damn good. So that means people are, they're feeling you. They're feeling you.
Yeah. I hope they feel us laying down. I mean, the laying down is going to tell whether they're feeling me or not, for real. Oh, yeah. It's a good CD, I think. Just met you just the other day.
What would you say? I know you get asked this often, but what would you say is the secret to being so successful for such a long period of time?
You got to take your time, go for what you want, and never give up.
Let's talk about Lay It Down, because this is something that is really special, I think. What was it like recording and working with young artists, not just because they're young, but because oftentimes young people have different musical tastes and sensibilities, don't they?
I would say so, yeah.
So what was it like with Questlove of the Roots and Corrine Bailey Ray and John Legend and Anthony Hamilton working
with them? It was like family. That's three times I've said that. It was like family. I mean, Anthony Hamilton is going to sing about I Love You. You all that means, that matters to me. I don't want nobody. Yeah. Yeah, lay it down.
Lay it down.
Oh, yeah.
Let it go.
Oh, baby. Put your head on the floor. Whoa, lay it down.
Lay it down. Let it go.
Get on out of here. Hey, one more thing. Then John Legend is going to sing the Love, 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 which is for Janet Rich up here. She's laughing. She's on the mic, too.
In the morning light, orange shades of white, you're the only one to try. So what's the meaning of saying?
So, I mean, Al is going to sing about, you know, I'm so tired of being alone. So, I mean, there you go.
Absolutely. It's vintage. It was vintage Al Green. It's particularly Lay It Down, the title track with Anthony Hamilton. Yeah. And for me, also, the songs Just For Me and You've Got the Love I
you
Need.
You Got the Love, Baby. Yeah, I Need.
Stardust in the sky.
What I'm so happy about is I went and wrote my verse. Anthony Hamilton, he wrote his own verse, and then we sang on the bridge and out. There you go.
It sounded great. You know, I have another question to ask you, and I've often been curious about this. One of the signature sounds that I think that you have is this, what I'll describe as this falsetto hum. You know what I'm talking about? How did that, because when I hear that, obviously it's Al Green, no matter where you are. How did that come about, Al?
By practicing.
The new CD has been received pretty warmly from what I have read. And the song that seems to be generating a great deal of critical acclaim is the duet with John Legend. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It really is doing a great job. And I'm just amazed at the reception it has gotten. And John is doing a great job on it. And that's Corrine Bailey Ray and myself back doing the background. So we're all singing on it, yeah.
One of the things that I noticed in looking at photographs of you over the years, from the 70s through the 80s mm-hmm. and 90s and now, is mm-hmm. Al Green, you look good still.
Oh, man.
How do you keep yourself
together?
You
see me now, man. I'm in a three-piece, man, white shirt and tie. All this is for you, man. I got some Concourse shoes on, the little Concourse gym shoes, you know.
Uh-huh.
Hey, man, I am cool, baby. I'm cool.
You still enjoy performing live?
I just did New Orleans the other day. It stopped raining just in time for us to get on stage. And the good Lord kept the rain away for an hour and 20 minutes. And when we were saying goodbye, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, it started to sprinkle again.
Really? What's the difference?
Tony!
Yeah, tell me. Now, tell me a little bit. We're not talking much about your personal life, but are you a family man now, or and how does that all fit into Al Green's world, because you have so many things going on?
Well, I mean, like my boy yesterday, we had to have a talk about his schooling and about him doing and getting grades that he should be getting and what group he should be in instead of the one he's in. And so we went out and had dinner and we talked about these things and we got an agreement that we're going to have to start doing the homework first, have dinner next, go over the homework, and be ready for school the next morning. We're going to apologize to our teachers for all the things that we said that was not correct, and we're going to turn a new leaf, start over, and he said, Dad, that's a good idea.
Al Green, I want to thank you. Family man, spiritual man, music man, performer, you are one of the classics, and I wish you all the best with Lay It Down.
Thanks, Tony.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with musician Al Green. And that's News and Notes. Nicole Childers and Christabel Nsiabwadi produce the show. Sasha Woodruff edits, and Kenya Young is our director. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Carlos Asensio is our drive engineer. Our staff includes Jeffrey Bennett, Roy Hurst, Devin Robbins, Ernest Champel, Jeffrey Gardner, Zachary Slobig, Drew Tewksbury, and Professor Tony Cox. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Next week, our bloggers' roundtable explores the stories that are heating up in cyberspace.